You are listening to Punk News Podcast, episode 556, with a special guest. And who is that special guest, you ask? Franz Nicolai of the Hold Steady. Franz Nicolai of Against Me. Franz Nicolai of Franz Nicolai Solo. World-renowned author Franz Nicolai. But he will always be Franz Nicolai of World Inferno to me. And here's a World Inferno track. What's happening? How you doing?
Hey, not too bad, thanks. Haven't melted yet, so that's a bonus.
Howie Bullet, what's your? I'm melting pretty bad right now, frankly. What's your melting status right now?
I just got lucky. It just happened to be the like couple of days that I had planned to be by the ocean. So then when I felt like I was gonna melt, I just jumped in the ocean and it saved me from all the meltage. And I'm feeling pretty good about it.
Central Jersey, South Jersey, which beach?
Down the shore, baby. Everybody always talks like all of New Jersey vacations at Long Beach Island, and I'd never been before. And I was always like, I just was sort of like, why does everyone go to this place? And then I went and I was like, oh, it's because it's awesome. The water's like super clear. It was like completely amazing. We had the best time.
Isn't that where Jersey Shore's at, filmed at?
Oh, you know, I don't know enough. I should know more about that show, but I don't really care.
Did you see Snooki?
I know who Snooki is, and I think the other guy was called The
Situation.
The Situation. I was going to say The Problem.
You know,
I was like, I don't think it was The Problem.
The Problem. We've got a great guest here, and I don't want to waste time, but I'm going to waste time, and here's why. I really did enjoy like the first two seasons of Jersey Shore because like the universe was so weird because The Situation lied, and he said to Snooki, I told your boyfriend that you were making out with some other guy, and Snooki got mad and started like screaming at him and like yelling at him and stuff. And then Situation went, aha, aha, I lied. I didn't tell him that. I fooled you. And then Snooki had to apologize to Situation because she got mad at him because he didn't actually do what he said he did, you know, which I love the warped morality of Jersey Shore. However, by like seasons 3, 4, and 5, it got like really depressing because they're like 38 and they're like, I can't wait to go to the shore and have some summer fun. I'm like, you're 38. I mean, Here, listen, we're here with our special guest, Franz Nicolai. Franz, I got two questions for you. First one, what's your stance on summer fun? Are you pro or con?
I'm pro summer fun. Who's against summer fun?
Damien Abraham of F'd Up. He's got a song about how much he hates the summer.
Oh, I mean, I definitely, like, anytime it's above about 65 degrees, I get progressively less happy. But, you know, I can still deal with it.
But listen, I mean, I'm psyched to have Franz here. Franz, I've known Franz now about 16 years, although I interviewed him once. And then about 5 or 6 years later, he said, John, can you come interview me at this bookstore for my cool new book, which at the time was Ladies of Border Patrol, which is a really cool book about Franz traveling through Mongolia. And I said, sure, I'll do it. And we met up and I'm like, Franz, good to see you again. And Franz like, what do you mean again? I said, Franz, I interviewed you in San Francisco at a bar before what do you call it when the women take off their clothes, but it's not a strip, burlesque. You know, and it was a burlesque show than World Inferno, and World Inferno had 3 shows in 3 days in the Bay Area, and Franz didn't remember me, and that hurt my feelings ever since. However, listen, we can let bygones be, but Franz, here's a question I've been dying to ask you. So the Insane Clown Posse, it's Violent J and Shaggy 2 Dope. And the question is, how can two people make a posse? Shouldn't it be like the Insane Clown Duo or like the Insane Clown Partnership or something?
I mean, I think if you're you can have a posse in your own head if you got enough people personalities you're arguing with.
So there is such a thing as a one man posse, you're saying?
I think it's I'm not saying they exist. I'm just saying it's theoretically possible.
Honestly, listeners, I'm kind of jerking Franz around, but what I love about Franz can dish it out with the best. Franz has got a very cool new book out. It's called Someone Should Pay for Your Pain, and it's a really cool book, and it's out right now. And basically what it's about, and Franz, correct me if you disagree with my synopsis, it's about a musician that had a famous album about 15 years ago, and his protege has become much more famous. And this musician named Rudy, he's touring, and wherever he goes, his protege or guy that was influenced by him was cool to him, but everyone's like, oh, so you know the famous guy, and it kind of bumped him out because he's forever attached to this more famous guy, which arguably kind of ripped him off. Franz, do you agree with my synopsis?
That's certainly part of it. That's one thread of it. Yeah. Org Core Star is Born.
So anyway, the book is out right now via Gibson House, and it's real cool. I've read the first quarter of it, and I've been really digging it so far. Franz is a fantastic writer, and he's really good at writing interesting things that could happen as opposed to like fantastical things about, you know, barbarians fighting space dragons. Like Franz's stories can and have happened. Franz, at least the first quarter, it seems that our main character, Rudy, he's kind of bummed out. He's kind of sad. My question is, why are we following a guy that's kind of bummed out and is kind of being overshadowed instead of someone that's in, like, say, Motley Crue and is, like, having a fun time and doing all these, you know, wild and crazy things?
I mean, I think it's the same reason some people like listening to sad music instead of listening to party music, right?
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
You do have a lot of melancholy music. I think it's the World Inferno live album where you're like, this song is meant to induce sadness and melancholy or something. Why should we revel in the sad feelings? And can that be dangerous, or maybe it's a healthy release?
I think people use it homeopathically, right? Like a small dose of sadness to avoid an ocean of depression.
That's what's great about Franz. Instead of just saying it's a good way to get out your feelings, Franz will be like, people use it homeopathically. with regards to this book, I mean, is this based on anybody? Is it taken from your own experiences, or is it like just totally fictional? You know,
I mean, it's fictional, but of course it's types. You know, if you read like an academic novel or a campus novel, You know, there's types that you recognize, like the absent-minded classics professor and the officious assistant dean, and everyone recognizes that those are types that exist on a campus. And I think, you know, anyone who's been involved in a music scene, the kind that we all have been, are going to recognize, like, oh yeah, we understand, like, the type of person who, you know, sounds like his most famous friend, and that sort of thing, without having to assign, you know, one-to-one relationships. You know, if you want to write a novel that feels like it has a certain amount of realism, you know, you're going to build your characters from someone's arm and someone else's leg, and, you know, Dr. Frankenstein style, throw a chimpanzee's heart in it, and eventually they get up walking around, and someone goes, "Doesn't that look like so and so's arm?" And you say, "Well, maybe it was so and so's arm, but now it's something else."
Do you feel as though people have ripped you off?
I no.
Oh, okay, fair enough then.
Not at all.
Not at all.
No, not at all.
Well, do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing? You know what I mean? Like, everyone ripped off the Ramones, and because it's because they're great, you know. But I guess on the other hand, like, no one's like really ripped off Frank Zappa because it's just too hard to do. Well, where do you think you fall into that spectrum?
I guess I don't understand what the spectrum is that you're.
The spectrum is
establishing here.
The spectrum is some people get ripped off because they're so fantastic, everyone rips them off, and some people can't get ripped off because they're too unique. You know what I mean?
I don't think I ever made enough money for it to be worth it for anybody to rip me off.
if anything, Franz, you've made so much amazing music throughout the years. That's a shame. Along those lines, you know, I was thinking, like, how come World Inferno wasn't the most famous band in the world? I mean, first of all, Franz, do you agree that World Inferno was an amazing band, especially when you were in it? Maybe you don't agree, but I definitely think it was.
Oh, 100%. It was.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
It was, in a lot of ways, that period, especially with that lineup from about, you know, 2001 to 2006, was like one of the, you know, probably the most magical time in my life.
If someone said to me Red Eyed Soul is the best album ever, I probably wouldn't disagree with them. You know, I mean, that is it sounds so amazing. The songs are so good. It's so unique, but it's a very accessible album. You know, last night I was listening to Cats Are Not Lucky Creatures, and I got very sad because that definitely could have been a massive radio hit. I mean, it really could have, you know. Why do you think – was World Inferno just too good? Like, some bands are just – like we're going to talk about the Suburban Lawns later on, who definitely, if you ask me, should be as famous as any punk band there is, as famous as X, as famous as Fear, and I love both those bands. Well, I like X. I don't love X. Like, why wasn't World Inferno, like, a massively famous band?
I mean, I think, you know, it's not for everybody. It's such a specific thing as many people loved it as thought we were just too weird or like didn't know what to make of it all. You know, the bands that we were like that had hits tended to be like a Dexy's Midnight Runners or Oingo Boingo or Chumbawamba, like freak one-offs that could have easily never had those hits. And you know, if you don't get that kind of luck, it's not going to happen. I mean, I remember Bill Cashman told me that he had asked. We had a song on that, the Fat Records Rock Against Bush comp, and a couple of years went by, and Cashman ran into Fat Mike and asked why he never signed World Inferno. He was like, they're too weird, you know. So if we're too weird for Fat Mike, we're probably too weird for the big time.
We played that song on the podcast not that long ago, like within the last like 5 months probably, right, John?
We certainly did, yes.
I can't remember why. Yeah.
That's like
because I love it, but I can't remember why it was like that particular week. I was like, this is the song I have to play.
I mean, we made a mistake, I think, by writing a song specifically for that comp. I think other people just did their songs that were already like their hits or that were already like part of their repertoire. And it didn't really come off in the studio, and it was unlike the other stuff we were doing at that time. It was like more songwritery. And so I don't know.
Oh, I loved it. I mean, that was how I got into that band. That song was like, it did what like you hope as a band a comp will do, because I didn't know World Inferno, and I heard that song and I was like, oh my gosh, I have got to know more about this band, you know?
That's cool. That's good to hear.
Yeah.
Franz, you said that the World Inferno time was one of the most magical times in your life. How come?
You know, it was a special world. It was a special group of people, incredible musicians. You know, Jack was at the peak of his game. It was the time, and also it's just that feeling of building something. You know, when I joined the band, we were playing for like 20 people at Brownies, and in a couple of years, we were playing, you know, we could sell at the Warsaw, and that, like, that's an amazing feeling. And just building that kind of family feeling within the band, but also within the fan base. I don't know. It's hard to reproduce, and sort of like has the end of it already built into it.
We won't get too into this topic, but one of the most fun things and most frustrating things about World Inferno is I interviewed Jack Terry Cloth a bunch of times. I did two big interviews with him. And the first time, I'm like, oh, I'm getting the real Jack Terry Cloth. Like, I really know who this guy is. And then when I did my next big interview with him, he told me facts that were in direct conflict with the facts he told me the first time. You know what I mean? So I feel as though I always dealt with the character, not the real person. Do you think you ever got the real person, or was the character the real person?
No, I don't. The character wasn't the real person. And I think I did. I think as the years went by, it became harder and harder to access the real person. And the character became more and more who you were dealing with. And that could be a frustrating experience.
Yeah. You do see that happen to a lot of musicians. Like, I think of Lee Scratch Perry, who acts crazy, but he's not as, I mean, he definitely has mental issues, if you will, but he's not as crazy as he acts, because if you interview with him and you demand actual answers, he'll give them to you. But if you don't, then he'll just talk in gibberish. You know what I mean? And so you see that happen. Like, people get caught in their own creations, you know?
Absolutely. I think it's a dangerous thing. I mean, I think, that's one of the benefits of not being the face of a group, is that you're not responsible for what people think of you every time you go out the front door.
That's actually probably pretty stressful too, isn't it? Franz, how anonymous are you in the street? Do people say, oh, that's Franz? Or they like, oh, he's just some guy?
Pretty anonymous now. There was a period, when I had the mustache and, I was still in World Inferno and Hold Steady was getting big, that would happen.
Was that fun or not fun?
Oh, I loved it. It's great for the ego.
Yeah, yeah. So Franz, you were also in the Hold Steady, a massive band, or at least a very, very big band. What's it like being up on stage in front of 20,000 people? Did you enjoy that more than World Inferno? Did you enjoy it the same? Did you enjoy it less? You know?
I mean, I don't know where you're getting your numbers from. We never played for any 20,000 people.
Didn't Hold Steady play festivals?
Yeah, we played. Okay, I see what you mean. Yeah, I mean, the biggest. Yeah, right. We played. We. The biggest crowd we played for was, we opened for the Stones in Dublin one time. That was like 60,000 people, but it's 60,000 people who are just like staring at you kind of blankly, waiting for the Rolling Stones to go on. So that's like sort of a weird experience. I mean, the feeling of playing for, 20,000 people at a festival and a packed room that's like, holds 50 people and there's 200 there is a similar feeling, and they're both equally thrilling.
Did you have any Stones interaction? Did you meet any of the Stones or any like Bobby Keys or anybody?
No, there was no interaction. They flew in on their helicopters as we were on stage.
Oh my gosh.
It was really dramatic. It was a storm, so it was like raining and thundering, and there's these helicopters coming in, and it was Sling Castle, so there's this sort of medieval fortress looking thing, and it was like, it was very much a very Apocalypse Now.
Were they all on one helicopter, or was it like president and vice president, and they never all ride in the same helicopter?
Well, I know there were multiple helicopters. I don't know who was in what helicopter.
Franz, would you want to be that famous? Like, and I mean, honestly, like everyone's like, yeah, I'd love to be like super famous and super rich. But if you look at like all the Rolling, aside from Charlie Watts, we're going to talk about at the end of the episode, Mick, Keith, Ron Wood, Brian Jones, they all have a lot of sadness and trauma in their life in addition to the joy. And I think that's certainly caused in part by massive fame. Would you want that?
No, I don't think I would want that. I mean, people say that that the sweet spot is being rich without being famous.
Fair enough. Franz, getting back to your book, and then we'll kick off the news. One of the things that I liked about your book is, our lead character, Rudy, he's in not a great spot at the beginning. And when I'm reading, I want him to win. And I guess my question is, is, did you write the book where we should want the character to win, or is it up to the viewer? I mean, let's look at Taxi Driver. Some people want Robert De Niro to kick ass and win, and some people are like, this is a creepy guy that's got problems. I don't want him to win, and we should just study him. What's your perspective on Rudy, the main character?
I think that when the average person, when they pick up a novel, is going to inherently identify themselves with the protagonist to some extent. And so if you know that going in, then you can play with that expectation and play with the sort of identification and that sort of rooting for the protagonist. I don't think you'll get to the end of the book at some point. I'm temperamentally inclined to avoid easy redemption arcs and, you know, easy moral judgments on any of the characters. So I guess that's my answer.
Actually, and along those lines, I've got sort of a thesis that a lot of people might disagree with, and that right now society demands that a lot of music, if it has a message, it has to be a positive moral message. Do you think art should have a moral or a message at all, or can art be messageless?
I think, of course, art can be messageless. I think some art, I'm suspicious of the idea that we demand of art moral education, because that's the road that leads to socialist realism. Not that there are some great socialist realist art, but that's, I don't think that's something that art should aspire towards.
Hold on a second. I got to put my graduation cap on for that sentence. listen, Franz is just blowing me away.
You're asking questions that have to have, you know, a slightly complicated answer.
Keep them coming. I mean, keep them coming. Franz, you actually are or were a college professor, right?
Yeah, I still am. That's my day job.
Yeah, is that fun? Do you like that?
I do. There's something a little bit – it's not unlike performing, especially solo performing. Because you're in a position where you have to get up in front of a room full of people who are, you know, don't always want to be there, don't always believe that they owe you their attention, and prove to them that they do.
Isn't that funny? Because they're paying to be there. You know what I mean?
Well, people also pay to go to shows. That doesn't mean they want to see the person on stage.
Mm-hmm. Well said. So, Franz, are you like a hard-ass professor? Are you like Mr. Easy? Like, do you do the thing where you turn the chair around and sit on it? And, like, how's everybody do it? You know, like what's your teaching strategy? Because the older I get, the more I think I appreciate hard-ass teachers that were hard-ass to teach you, but not necessarily hard-ass just to be dicks. Like, what's your style?
I would say I'm not a hard ass, because that's not really my style in life. And, you know, in life, in the classroom, as on the stage, I think in a lot of ways, the closer you can be to your authentic self, whatever that is, the easier it's going to be, and the less you have to rev yourself up and put on a persona. I don't know if an ideal classroom is one where we're all there sort of working towards a shared goal. I prefer it when it can be a sort of freewheeling conversation. That's not always the case. Again, you know, you don't, and you have students who are going through all kinds of things in their lives, and try to work with them and try to make, you know, I want everybody to get an A. That's my goal, you know? So I'm willing to work with anybody to get to that, spot.
I guess last question, Franz. In the book, in the beginning, Rudy, the main character, is arguing with a promoter who's kind of trying to short him. Franz, what do we do with shady promoters that don't come through with the guarantee? Should we treat them brutally and get what they promised out of them, or what should we do? Because I have a definite opinion.
I mean, of course you want to get what you were promised. You know, you're trying to meet your budget. You're trying to not lose money on your tour. Nobody wants to lose money. That sounds like an Alec Bailey question.
Because you definitely get paid what you're owed if there's a contract.
What I hear is he was the guy that could get that, you know, stood for no messing around on that front.
Well, there you have it. Franz's new book is out now. It's out via Gibson House. It's called Someone Should Pay for Your Pain. It's a great book. Everyone should check it out. And if you like it, pick it up and buy it. Listen, people, buy books. This book included, and other books as well. So anyway, this book is real cool. Where's the best place to get it, Franz? The bookstore, the internet, where should people check it out?
Wherever they like to get their books. I mean, they can get it from franznikolai.com if they want. They can get it from bookshop.org. You can order it, you can get it at whatever your local indie bookstore is.
They have it. Also, I will say, punk music is a tiny shout out in Franz's book, so I appreciate that. So thank you, Franz. Let's play something from Red Eyed Soul. Let's play something happy. Let's play Brother of the Mayor of Bridgewater. And here we go.
Casually brave, that made me less lonely and it helped me compared to the probe young nerves of I look for you in crowds, I don't know where you are. Man, uphill to the gills, prowling through bars. You and Mr. is the man of this mark. I hope that you know.
Do some news. Franz is hanging around, which I'm excited about. And listen, let's look at the news for today. This is a big one. So listen, I guess it was last week was Psycho Las Vegas, where Danzig played, and he did all of Danzig 2, and apparently everyone was thrilled and everyone thought it was great. However, another person that was also supposed to play Psycho Las Vegas and pulled out about 2 or 3 days beforehand was Wino of St. Vitus. I don't know if he's in St. Vitus now. He's in and out. Anyways, Wino's – you guys think I should read this whole statement?
I can't remember how long it was.
I'll read it.
Because, if you're asking that, I'm assuming it's long.
I'm just going to plow through because Wino says a lot here. Wino says, 2 evenings ago, I received an email from Psycho Las Vegas wherein they informed me and other artists that this event – I guess he's writing a contract – wherein they informed me and other artists that this event would require that all people, attendees, and artists wear a mask at all times indoors, the exception only being while singing on stage. All non-singing musicians, band members, etc. are required to be masked during the performance, which actually I'm not sure was accurate, frankly. This includes drummers. Also, as soon as the performance is over, artists will be required to re-don masks in backstage, front of house, VIP lounges, and common areas. I have dug very deep when researching COVID-19, and not just on YouTube, But in scientific publications, journals, and lectures, I believe the virus exists and has been weaponized, as has been proven in the congressional hearings where the evidence is overwhelming. Our government, NIH, has been complicit in the financing and shared scientific lab work creating a SARS-based super coronavirus designed specifically for lethality. I guess that's a word. Oh, lethality? I guess that's a word. And easy dissemination amongst the human population. Bioweapons are nothing new, but in my personal opinion, pure evil. Early on in the so-called pandemic, it was stated by the CDC that PCR tests were inaccurate in determining if one had the virus because they are designed for individuals who were already symptomatic. The CDC quickly backtracked that it was a design, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, blah, blah, blah. The virus, I believe, was created as a depopulation tool and fear associated with it as a means to subjugate and enslave you and I, the common people. I cannot in good conscience perform my music in an environment that is designed to take away individuality, civil liberties, and free will. I will not be performing this night at Psycho Las Vegas, not out of fear, but out of principle. If we, the people, continue to blindly accept this tyranny, we are destined for enslavement. These are my personal views, but I urge everyone to dig deep. My apologies to my friends and fans, but it's time to wake up. And so that's Wino's statement. Along those lines is Punk Rock Bowling, which is in about 1 month, also updated their, I guess, COVID requirements, however you want to phrase it. You have to have proof of vaccination, but the way you do that is not by showing your vaccination card. The way you do that is by downloading an app and putting certain personal information into the app and then going to Punk Rock Bowling and showing them the app, and then they give you like a wristband or something like that. Halle Bullet, Wino, thumbs up, thumbs down. What do you think?
John, I'm so tired about I'm so tired of talking about COVID on a music podcast. Like, how much time do we have to spend talking about COVID? And it's like, it's just so frustrating, right? Because it's just everything. There is no aspect of our lives or culture, anything, that is not in some way also wrapped up in the bullshit debate over COVID and whether it's real or how to handle it. I'm sick of talking about it. I mean, I'll just say that if he thinks that COVID was invented by rich elites as some evil form of population control and he objects to that, then maybe he would just want to wear his fucking mask so he can stop the spread of the evil virus that he thinks is invented by rich elites as a form of population control. Do you know, I just, none of it makes sense to me. I'm tired of talking about it. So, well, no, thumbs down. Sorry, Wino.
It definitely doesn't make sense in that, like, rich people would want a lot of poor population that has to work to keep them rich. Like, it doesn't make any sense at all, you know. Like, I do how he's like, COVID exists and is dangerous, so I'm not gonna wear a mask. Take that. You're a big fan of metal, so I assume you agree with Wino on this statement, right?
Horns up all the way. I made the blood pact. I have to honor it. Oh my God. So I don't agree with this at all. This, like, the first thing that crossed my mind was, is he okay? Like, has something happened? Is he all right? Like, what causes someone to kind of go off on this and believe this? Like, oh, you've dug deep. Where are your sources? What have you been reading? Like, what, you know, what caused this? And yeah, like, it doesn't make any sense because it's like, I believe the virus is dangerous, this is the origin of the virus, but masking is bad, masking is, you know, I don't get it. I don't understand that part of it at all. Masking's been around for a long time. It's not new anymore. It's been proven effective time and time again. Contagious diseases are down, like, flus and colds aren't as prevalent now as they were, you know, a couple years back, because of the use of masking. And if you went into a hospital, you know, and somebody, like the doctors and the nurses are dealing with a contagious patient and they're not wearing a mask, and then they come over to you, like, you know, you'd have complaints, you know. So how is this any different just on the masking standpoint?
Franz, as a man that has opened for the Rolling Stones, how do you feel about Wino's statement, but also how do you feel about music festivals requiring proof of vaccination?
I mean, I think it's it's the least they can do. It's a tough. They're in a tough situation. I've never heard of that guy.
You never heard of Wino?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen. Wino is a very important guy in heavy metal. He was not the first singer, but the most famous singer for Saint Vitus. Saint Vitus is widely considered to be the most famous doom metal band. They're basically the first band that tried to be like sound exactly like Black Sabbath, which a million bands do now. They're also very important because they were on SST Records. They were the first metal band on SST Records. And they're also important because I saw Saint Vitus in Santa Cruz in about 2014, and they were just okay. Franz, go ahead.
I mean, historically, we don't go to people in metal bands for, like, great opinions on politics or, you know, public health. So, I don't know. I'm with Hallie. I don't know why we would want to spend a lot of time publicly discussing this guy's opinions on public health.
Well, I'm all for hearing contrasting views. And also, I mean, I'm all for, like, what is it? I think M kind of touched on it. It's like, why is this guy that whacked out? I mean, I can get not agreeing with everything that the majority says. But here, it's such common sense that COVID is a real thing that you definitely should protect everyone against. And the only way we're going to beat it is if everyone works together. And that's not what he's urging towards, you know, so. Why do these people feel that way? You know what I mean? I guess nobody knows.
It's just rough. We can't know. We can't be inside people's heads. But there just seems to be a lack of like logic or a through line in his argument. But I feel like you talk to a lot of people that aren't whacked out and they also have like a very illogical through line that they're telling themselves about COVID. So I don't know what makes people susceptible to this. Cause I do think it's like some of them are crazy, but you can't write them all off as crazy. So it's just a lot of people are pushing this shit.
Hallie, are you requesting a COVID discussion moratorium on the Punk News podcast?
No. I'm not.
You can.
It's in everything. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It seeps into every it wasn't a comment on like the choice of topics. It's just a comment on like, I just can't believe how this just seeps into everything right now. It's just so tiresome, you know?
Do you think the listeners are tired of hearing
the conversation? I think about, you know, the important conversations the music world has to be having is how to safely have shows and how to safely have festivals. So I am curious that, you know, Punk Rock Bowling's trying to have an app, other people, you know, it's great to ask for proof of vaccination, but if, you know, these cards are pretty flimsy things, most people are, you know, showing pictures of their vaccination cards. It's not like it's a foolproof, it's more or less the honor system. And that's probably not a long-term solution either. But we got to try out a bunch of different stuff if we want to keep having shows and festivals. I mean, I'm real jealous of I haven't gotten to play a show, since shows started happening again. I'm jealous of my friends who are getting to do it. And, I'll be real bummed if it all shuts down again before I get to. So, I'm willing to try all these different things.
Yeah.
Not to drag out the conversation. If you guys want to kick it forward, we can, but I'm not thrilled with the app for Punk Rock Bowling. You know, we sort of had the precursor to this conversation is if we could say you have to show proof of vaccination at a concert to, you know, to cause a COVID, and then afterwards, you know, we're not going to have those requirements, whatever, I'd be fine with it. But like this app, you got to get a lot of personal information to you, and it's a private company, you know, and private companies get hacked and private companies definitely exploit your material. And also I'll point out that it's a free app. And so if it's a free app, it means you're not the consumer, you're the product. So I'm really not thrilled with giving like my social security number to some app that I don't even know. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess I just wish I knew more about the app. Like, it's a private company, and is it a private company that I don't know that I just wish I knew more about it because I don't know how to feel about giving that particular company my information or not. It sort of depends who's behind it and Is it in any way connected to the? It's not in any way connected to the government or anything that's like an official medical thing. It's just a private company.
The company's called Clear, and many, many different events and places have used this. I think you might even be able to use it on like airplanes or something.
Oh, yeah. That's always seemed like kind of, I don't know. Right. Yeah, that Clear on airplanes makes me angry because I just don't understand why you should be able to pay a lot of money and then like suddenly you just don't have to wait on the same security line as everybody else. That just has always bothered me. But yeah, that's interesting that that's the company that's doing this. Yeah, I don't know how to feel about that. I mean, but I'm with Franz. It's like we have to figure out a way to do this safely. So I guess we just have to start. We just have to start trying stuff. It's, you know. I wish the government had more of an app because the government already has all my information. So then I don't mind giving, you know, I wish the government was coming up out with something that was just like a blanket thing that everyone could use, that events could use, that, you know, I think that, because would you, in that case, John, would that wouldn't feel alarming to you, right? Because the government already knows your shit, right?
If it was a government, I mean, honestly, at this point, I thought a punk rock bowling, you just have to show your paper card and they let you in, which I wasn't thrilled about, but I was willing to accept. But it turned out Clear is $15 a month, although maybe it's free through punk rock bowling. But $15, mm-hmm. Man, like I want to pay a private company $15 a month to exploit my most sensitive information, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know, man. I'm not thrilled. But I don't have an answer, you know, so. I wish I did. But listen,
that's the thing I always say is like I'm just kind of glad I'm not the person that has to be making decisions about this stuff because it just feels overwhelming and it kind of feels like hard. You can't. I don't. It feels very like lose right now. It doesn't feel like the people making these decisions they're just in a bad spot, man. I'm glad it's not me.
Well, listen, let's hit people with another semi-bummer story. And then we got three happy articles after that. So how about that? Listen, the Nirvana baby is suing Nirvana. Who's the Nirvana baby? His name is Spencer Alden. And he's suing Nirvana. He's suing a whole bunch of people. He is suing Nirvana, Dave Grohl, Chris Novoselic, Universal Music Group, Geffen Records, Kirk Weddle, who took the picture of the baby in the pool, Courtney Love, Chad Channing. Who's Nirvana's original drummer and was not credited on the actual album, as well as other people. Of course, he's suing because the cover of Nirvana's Nevermind has him as a baby in a swimming pool chasing a dollar, and you can see his wiener. And basically, as a baby, mind you, not as a grown person. Basically,
he always refers to – I've seen him refer to it in interviews as his baby penis. So you could just say they show his baby penis.
So he's got an attorney. The attorney's name is Robert Y. Lewis, which I think is amusing because who's the Alice in Wonderland guy? Wasn't that Robert Lewis?
No,
it wasn't. Carol Lewis. Never mind. I take that back. Anyways, he's got an attorney and he's suing all of them for basically, I think it's like six causes of action, but they're all rooted in the same exact thing, and that's the following. This is the allegation. Defendants knowingly produced, possessed, and advertised commercial child pornography depicting Spencer, and they knowingly received value in exchange for doing so. Despite this knowledge, defendants failed to take reasonable steps to protect Spencer and prevent the widespread sexual exploitation and image trafficking. Under the lawsuit, every defendant is being sued for $150,000 plus punitive damages. I'll point out that this is not a copyright infringement lawsuit. He's not saying that they didn't have the legal right for the picture itself. What he is saying is the picture itself is child pornography and has been exploited. The $150,000 claim is very interesting for a number of reasons. Most interesting to me is Hallie Bullock. Do you know why $150,000 is a magic number?
No.
$150,000 is a magic number because if you sue someone for statutory copyright infringement, that's the most you can request per work infringed. So it's curious that even if it's not a copyright infringement case, he's asking for the maximum under copyright statutory damages, which maybe is a coincidence. Maybe someone just got their wires crossed. I don't know. M. Moore, we'll kick it off with you. Okay. There's two ways to look at this. And most people were saying this guy, he's reposed for this picture many, many times. He's done interviews about it. He's joked about it. The only reason he's saying this now is because he wants money and he doesn't actually feel like he was harmed. The other argument, which I don't see a lot of people making, but some people have made, is that, well, he was a little kid. He never got any money out of this picture, and it's arguably one of the most famous record covers of all time. So I can understand how he might feel bummed out that his naked baby photos are all over and it is extremely iconic, and he didn't see one red cent from it. Where do you stand, Edmore?
I'm kind of on the fence because there's certain things for that support like each side, and I don't really know. I don't have a concrete thing yet, because I'd read one thing and I'd be like, yep, here's where I am, and then I'd read something else and it just became like I don't have a clear picture of who he is. So like, he has a Nevermind tattoo on his chest. He seems to have been very proud of appearing on it and like telling people about it and doing the press and doing all this kind of stuff, because if he didn't do that, like, would anyone really know who he was? You know, would anyone be like, oh yes, that's Spencer Eldon as a baby on the cover? It'd just be that is a baby on the cover, you know, and wouldn't really have a grown-up face with it. One thing I did come across, but I couldn't find a lot of information on, was he tried to take legal action against Geffen Records, but was unsuccessful a couple years ago. And that wasn't child pornography, but it was something to do with the cover too. And I don't think that the intent of the cover is like
pornographic.
Yeah, I don't think it is, because the inspiration was water births. So then it's like, oh yes, you're born, and then boom, you gotta get the money, you know, and stuff. And I don't think there's anything remotely pornographic about a water birth and about a baby just going like, hey, you know. So I don't understand that angle. It unless it's just well, he was 4 months old when the picture was taken, so unless it's trauma that he's really buried and it's come up. Because where was it here? Yeah, so he alleges he suffered lifelong damages, which are emotional distress and, quote, a lifelong loss of income earning capacity. So, but he's an artist and he seems, I don't know. Anyways, there was also another thing where he's an artist. He had an art gallery. He asked the band to contribute something. The band, he couldn't get through to talk to somebody. He's never met the band. And then he's like, oh, well, why am I still on the cover if I'm not a big deal later in life? So I don't know. I think it's like the first instinct was it's a money grab thing, but I don't want to discount it if like he does have some trauma attached to it, you know. Yeah. Where do you guys stand on it?
I don't know. I mean, I do think it's messed up when, you know, when someone's image is used. You know, I think his family got paid $200 for him to take this picture. And obviously, like, a lot of money has been made off of that album, but not just because of the cover. Obviously, a lot of money was made off of the album because of the music. You know, the cover is obviously a huge part of the statement that they made, but it's not... it's not like this money was made just selling a picture of Spencer Eldon or whatever his name is. You know what I mean? Like, they sold their art, which was music. So it's hard to say, you know. It's like you do when you model for something and you accept a certain amount of money for that, and you don't write up a contract that says you are going to be paid in perpetuity for your image being used, then that's just sort of like thumbs the brakes. I'm with you, Em. It seems like this is a little bit of a retaliation for him not having anything contributed by the band or that the album cover photographer for his art show. That definitely seems to be like what sort of set this off. And you know, like, one of his grievances was that like, girls will date him because he's the guy from the Nirvana album cover, but then when they find out he's not rich, they dump him. That, like, seemed to be one of his, like, big grievances. And, like,
oh my God.
And the pornography claim is just, it's it's not pornography. It's just not pornography. So if like if that's the main claim of this lawsuit, it's just it's not. I mean, it's like, does that mean that any baby whose naked image like appears in like a textbook or like a medical textbook, like can they turn around and like sue and say that they were used for pornography? It just it doesn't. You know, but I agree. I can see where maybe, you know, if as a younger person, he was posing and recreating this image and getting a big kick out of it. I can definitely get where you might reach a point in your life where you're like, actually, you know, this feels kind of fucked up and sad for me. But I don't think you then turn around and like sue because you are trying to say it's pornography. That just is a leap to me. I don't know. Gentlemen, how would you feel about your baby penis being on a world famous album?
What I will say is Hallie brings up an excellent point is I think most people agree it's not pornography. And if this is pornography, that means any naked baby is pornographic. And to me, that suggests that if a picture of a naked baby is pornographic, that means everybody's a pervert. And I don't think everybody's a pervert. You know what I mean? Like, so I would say this is not pornographic, but Franz, here's a deep dive cut for you. Can you name another album within the punk rock universe that is a blue album that has a naked baby on it that was banned for being obscene?
No.
Chumbawamba's Anarchy album has a baby being born against a blue background, and it was censored in some countries, including America. And Chumbawamba was making the point that you can literally show someone getting shot to death on an album cover, but why can't you show a baby being born, which is one of the purest things there is? How is that obscene, but someone getting shot isn't? Thanks, Chumbawamba. Franz, do you sympathize with Nirvana, the very rich Dave Grohl, or the poor, broke, naked baby?
It seems stupid to me. If he should take it up with his parents if he's genuinely upset. But my instinct is that he's not genuinely upset.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about it.
Well, here's the answer, everyone. Basically, I don't think he's really upset about. I mean, listen, I can get being bummed out, not getting millions and millions of dollars, and your pictures all over the world. You know, I don't think that actual baby part is much, or if any of it, particularly since he's had a lot of fun recreating it. That really suggests it didn't bother him in the past, and he was actually kind of thrilled that he got some fame out of it. I will say, from a legal strategy standpoint, his attorneys, a lot of people, like in lawyer circles, that were like a lot of my lawyer friends or whatever, talking about this, is they're like, well, this lawyer is cockamamie, you know, like they've got no claim, which they probably really don't. But if you really look at it, the lawyer isn't asking for $100 million. They're asking for $150,000. So does Dave Grohl really want to litigate this for, say, a $60,000 settlement and look bad and look like the guy that's screwing the guy that got $200 for one of the famous cover albums of all time? Or does he just want to pay $40,000 or $50,000 and make it go away? And not every defendant has that money, you know, but Dave Grohl, Chris Novoselic, the record company, Courtney Love, they'll probably each pay $20,000 to $30,000 to make it go away. So from a pure strategy standpoint, I think it's played really well, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
Unless, like, are they all going to band together and spend $500,000 to $1 million to blow this guy out of the water, which they could, but do they want to, or do they all just want to pay $20,000 each and make it go away? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So from a strategy standpoint, it's pretty smart. From a moral standpoint, well, actually, I don't even like people that had hatred for this guy. I don't have hatred for him. You know, he's got no money. I mean, and listen, I mean, everyone can. Well, he's got no money, but he's famous, but he's not rich. Franz said the best thing is being rich but not famous. This guy's famous but not rich. You know, and so I have some sympathy for him, but I think when it comes down to it, Nirvana's in the right, he's in the wrong, you know. And, you know, sometimes you get a raw deal, and I think he's sort of got a raw deal, and maybe he should say, like Franz says, Mom, how come you signed away my wiener for $200? You know, we should have got a percentage, you know.
And in the meantime, cheapening the accusation of child pornography.
What's that?
Yeah.
In the meantime, cheapening the accusation of child pornography.
Well, that's a thing. That's a thing too. And also, and not to drag this conversation out, that does bend back around. I think pretty much. Well, we can say that this album cover is not pornographic. So to make it pornographic, not only does it cheapen the accusation of child pornography, like Franz says, but also it hypothetically threatens art as well. You know, so It's a multifaceted thing. It really is. Anyway, M. Morris. I mean, speaking of multifaceted thing, third face, that's at least three facets. Tell us about it.
All right. So Third Face, they are a hardcore punk band out of Nashville. And they just released a video for their song Villains. So Villains is off their 2020 album, Do It With a Smile. And I played the song on the podcast before. Fun fact. So I love the video and I love how it works with the song and everything. So like the video has people like they're working and they're being mistreated and their work is like cutting down trees and everything. So one of the people, one of the workers that they center on is played by Diana Zadlow. So she's worked with the band before and she did their promo photos. So one night a cloaked figure shows up in her little dwelling and where is it here? Yeah, so the figure gives her a sword and the words are like the figure says are return to the common person what has been theirs all along and turn these green pastures red with the blood of your oppressors. So she goes on a killing spree, including the cloaked figure and the bad exploitative bosses and everyone who's tormenting them. So the theme of the song, just with what the cloaked figure said, like some of the lyrics are same shit, different day. We work our fingers to the bone for dying wage. I never asked for this. When I see you all living in bliss, how do we find a way out of this trap? Can't see, won't see. We could put their backs against the wall. So it just plays out the lyrics really well, which works really well because the song, sometimes you can't make out the lyrics that well. So I thought it was really good. What did you guys think of the Third Face video?
I thought
John,
it was cool.
You liked it?
Yeah, I thought it was rad. I think the song was real cool. I thought the video was really cool. It's kind of got that B-horror, like with all, like the blood spraying out, kind of the trauma blood thing. I thought it was cool and rad. And one of the things that I always – this is definitely an M. Moore band. And what I mean by M. Moore band is extreme sounding or unusual band – sounding band. Not necessarily extreme sounding, but unusual band that has that takes, I guess, traditional sounds – subverts them, but uses them to their own design or to a design that hasn't been used before that causes the majority of our commenters to feel discomfort and uneasy. And I'm 100% behind that. And that's why I like this video a lot. Hallie Bullitt, what do you think?
No, I felt uncomfortable and uneasy at this video. No, you guys, this video is so intense. Oh, I mean, I'm glad you liked it. I just like no, I you know if you like are upset about like the oppression of the worker, like go vote. I don't have a trippy hallucination where you are told to kill people with a sword and then you do it. It's like. I don't know. I couldn't handle this. I don't know. I'm a lightweight. I could not handle this video at all.
John, did you enjoy the carnage?
Me?
Yes.
Oh, I warned you ahead of time. I don't have an opinion on a bunch of these news items. So
fair enough. Well, and more. Let's play a track, and we'll come back, and we'll talk about some more cool stuff.
Okay, so. I am going to play a song by a Brooklyn-based post-punk band. They're called Gustav, and the song is called Book. And on the story for this, which ran a couple, at least a month ago, somebody commented, "This is so weird." So this is Book by Gustav.
Show me the look that I gave you.
Gustav, and we'll just kick through this one pretty quick just because it's rad. DFL are back after, I think, 21 years. They're releasing their new EP. The new EP is called Why Are You DFL? And the song is called Why Are You DFL? And the video for the song is called Why Are You DFL? And it rocks and it rips. And DFL is sounding fantastic. I think if you like DFL, you will love this new EP. That's what a little birdie told me. I love this track. Halle Bullet, Why Are You DFL? Do you enjoy the throwback hardcore? The throwback to the throwback band that throwback to hardcore from the 80s?
I mean, I do. I appreciate it. I appreciate it's just like they're just doing sort of old school hardcore. I feel like, you know, you look at bands like Turnstile are really trying to take hardcore and like take it in a new direction or do something that's like a hybrid with another music genre. And I appreciate that these guys are it's just hardcore. And even the video is just like, it's just an old school hardcore video. It's the band is hanging out and singing the song and that's it. And yeah, I just sort of like it's straightforward and simple in a way that I like. I found it pleasing.
Franz, are you into hardcore at all? Do you enjoy that kind of stuff or not really?
I like it in theory. you know, the people that I know who are super into hardcore, they don't always make it sound that appealing. You know, it seems like a lot of it's always I understand that this is a stereotype, but it's been borne out in my experience that and maybe because these are mostly people who are obsessed with 80s hardcore, that it's like really intense young white dudes who have a lot of really strongly held opinions. And that's a little exhausting. But, you know, I understand it's very important.
Franz, did you know that there's 1 degree of separation between you and DFL?
Is there? Probably.
Franz played on the fantastic Leftover Crack track, Soon We'll Be Dead, and some other tracks on that album as well, right?
Yeah, I think I'm the only person besides Sturgeon who's played with Choking Victim, Leftover Crack, and Star Fucking Hipsters.
Oh, I didn't know you played with Choking Victim. That's pretty cool. Was that like a reunion or back in the old days?
No, it was some of those live shows in Tompkins when John Dolan was drumming.
Oh, wow. Was that fun?
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, how was it not? I had no stake in it, you know. It would be like someone call me up and be like, hey, can you bring your keyboard and play on Infested or whatever? And I'd be like, sure, sounds like fun.
Well, Franz is of rarefied talent again. However, here's the connection. Franz played with and in, I'd argue, in Leftover Crack, who also played in Leftover Crack, AWOL, who also did AWOL play with DFL, and who also did AWOL play with Suicidal Tendencies. And did you know, M. Moore, that there is 1 degree of separation between Franz Nicolai and the Beastie Boys? AWOL also played in the Beastie Boys.
Oh. I didn't know that.
This is going to be the new hot drinking game, 6 degrees of Franz.
I mean, I think
all of the college kids are going to be doing this.
I think it's safe to say that Franz is basically a Beastie Boy at this point, which is pretty cool.
I wonder if you could make more connections through me or through Mike Yerg.
I think you guys are neck and neck.
I would argue that I open up a couple different, like you can get into like new music world or in ways that you can't necessarily with Mikey.
Yeah.
Or I don't know.
I think that's some of the
farther reaches of indie rock, but we'd have to open up the board game.
Franz also played in SFH, as Franz stated, as did Mikey Erg. So there's a connection right there.
Oh, so it's all the same game.
I guess that's true.
Enmore, DFL, thumbs yes. up or two thumbs up?
Two thumbs up. I thought it was really cool. I thought it was good. The simplicity of the video was good, and it like matched with the song really well. And there was a skateboard in it, and that was really cool. And Tony Hawk just released the Bloodboard. So that was kind of like on my mind. And then I was like, this would be cool in like a Tony Hawk game, like as a song. So that was my experience with it. But I'm looking forward to the EP. I think it's going to be good.
Yeah, I agree. Let's talk about a band from way back in the day, the Suburban Lawns. And people say, John, who are the Suburban Lawns? The Suburban Lawns put out one album and one EP. And the lead singer was Sue Tissue. And the Suburban Lawns, to me, are one of these punk bands that should have been gigantic and famous and just weren't, maybe because they were too good, maybe because they were slightly too weird, but they were fantastic just before the hardcore era. Sue Tissue was the singer, and then after she put out a solo album, I think it's called like Sue Tissue Music Concrete or something like that, and then she disappears, and no one knows where Sue Tissue is. Apparently she's kind of an odd person. But who knows? She's also in the movie, I think it's Something Wild, or for like 2 minutes. And that's the last anyone ever saw of her or something like that. So anyways, the Suburban Lawns album, it's kind of punk. It's kind of new wave. It's definitely weird. It is a West Coast punk, early punk masterpiece. It actually was the album is being reissued now on Superior Viaduct for like $19, which is extremely reasonable. Superior Viaduct has connections to the Avengers. What's interesting is the album was also re-released in 2015 under the UK's Futurismo label, and those copies go for like $200, bizarrely. So I'm glad Superior Viaduct is doing a straight reissue and making a nice version out of it. This is a record everyone should have in their collection. And more, Suburban Lawns, are you excited?
I'm excited to listen to more of them because I only knew the Janitor song. So I think it'll be – well, I'm looking forward to getting more into them and listening to more songs than just that one. But, I think it's going to be cool with them. I love her voice, how it, like, kind of, you know, goes and sounds really nuts in parts. So
her vocals are really, really off the chain.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but like the vocals are so nuts, right? I like love it. Yeah.
Hallie, you're down with the Suburban. Were you familiar with the Suburban Lawns? Because some people like know all about them, and some people that like it's like the most obscure band they never heard of. For example, we were talking about Fat Mike. There's a famous interview between Bill Stevenson and Fat Mike, and Bill Stevenson starts talking about the Suburban Lawns, and Fat Mike has no idea who they are, and Bill Stevenson's like, "How do you not know who the Suburban Lawns are?" You know.
Well, I didn't really know much about them. Like, I knew that, like, just in sort of knowing a little bit of the history of, like, Saturday Night Live and music on Saturday Night Live, like, I knew that the video, I knew that Jonathan Demme had directed a video for them that had played on SNL. And then I guess you'll hear some people sort of bitterly say that Fear completely ruined, Saturday Night Live, like punk bands could no longer like play or have anything like shown on Saturday Night Live after like the Fear performance. But so I sort of knew about them in terms of like that, but like I really didn't understand how amazing they were. I'm really glad that we're like covering this story because I just like listened to more of their stuff, and Janitor is like so amazing. Like the words are, the chorus is, "I'm a janitor, oh my genitals." It's like just so out there and like so amazing. She sounds like she's singing in another language, but it is English. And like, I love that. Like there's like, I think actually it's the video that you posted, John, in the article on this is a lyrics video. It's not the video that played on Saturday Night Live back in the day. Or no, it was Gidget Goes to Hell was the video that played on Saturday Night Live. But the video for Janitor, there is an actual music video that exists. But the video you posted is a lyrics video, which is so funny to read the lyrics while she's singing. Because you're like, wait, that's what she's saying? Like, she just is really, I don't know. I'm like so in favor of this. I'm glad this album's getting a reissue. That's amazing. So you were like a longtime fan of this band, John?
Yeah, I've been a fan for like 10 years. So some people have been fans since day one. I got into this band about 10 years ago, and I tracked down the two singles and the album they put out, and eventually the EP. And listen, if you haven't heard this, like the album is so fantastic. Like, I don't want to overstate it, but I kind of can. It is an awesome, awesome album. It is the ideal first wave West Coast punk band that some songs are aggressive, some songs are weird, but it's not like tough guy macho. It's just kind of arty and weird. It's the West Coast response, I guess, to the CBGB's art house scene. And I love the phrase in Janitor, man, expansion, contraction, man, the manipulator. You know, she's talking about like humans almost as if she's not a human. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Which I love that phrase. Franz, you have any connection to Suburban Lounge or anything?
You know, I'm excited about this because that's one of those names that I've heard tossed around for years and I've never sat down and checked it out, so I'm adding it to my list as I'm listening to you talk. I'm psyched to listen to it.
Everybody should check out this album for sure. Hallie Bullet, play a tune, and we'll come back and we'll do a kind of a sad story, but it was a good run. But play a song, and we'll be right back, and we'll wrap this one up.
I mean, we've got to play Janitor at this point, right? Like, we just have, because if people haven't heard it, I think a lot of people haven't, because I hadn't. Like, I just sort of knew of them as a history sort of blip. But yeah, if this is a great song. This is Janitor by Suburban Lounge.
Suburban Lounge, and I guess we're going to close today with, it's a sad story, but Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones has passed away. He was 80, and it was kind of a shocking news because just literally like a week beforehand, the Rolling Stones said for the first time ever, Charlie Watts isn't going to come on tour, and then they said, but he'll be back once he recovers. They said he had an operation, but it went well, and now he's recovering, and he'll be back with us, you know, in the future. And then all of a sudden, they were like, Charlie Watts has passed away, so it's very sad. Charlie Watts, definitely one of the greatest drummers of all time. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards would always say Charlie's the greatest drummer ever. And I'd be like, why do they keep saying that Charlie's a great drummer? And then at least from my perspective, you listen to him and you realize that he's not trying to be a drummer. He's a musician, and he's actually kind of like driving the whole band forward and doing exactly what is necessary to make the song great, no more, no less. Like, John Bonham's an awesome drummer, but he, you know, he's boom, boom, bat, bat, boom, boom, bat. He's making a racket, which Charlie Watts is, I guess what you might say, more tasteful, but I don't even like that word. I would say he's more tactical in his drumming, and he's an amazing drummer and a very unique guy. And I did see in, like people's retrospectives, they're like, Charlie Watts, he's the classy guy, you know, always the gentleman. And Charlie Watts is a classy guy and always a gentleman. But I don't think – he was a three-dimensional person, and he was – he had his fair share of wild oats is what I'm saying. He's, I mean, you know, in the Rolling Stones, you're definitely at least sowing some wild oats, you know. Although a lot of people did mention that, like, while, like, Keith and Mick were, like, dancing around and doing everything, Charlie Watts just sits there like he doesn't care, which is true, although I think he did care. But like he just looks so if you look at his face, he looks like he's just bored to tears, you know. And meanwhile, he's doing the best drumming ever. Franz, as a musician, Charlie Watts, I believe Hold Steady covered Rolling Stones a couple of times, right?
I don't think so.
Oh no, well you opened for him, so we Charlie Watts.
We opened for him one time. Charlie Watts, incredible, easily the coolest member of the Rolling Stones, you know. And I don't know about whether he sowed wild oats or what, but he stayed married to the same woman for 57 years, you know, while being in the Rolling Stones in the 1970s, for goodness sake. So I think that counts for a lot. He always seemed like he wasn't impressed by being in the Rolling Stones, which made him cool. And that all the other members of the Rolling Stones, even as they hated each other, they all seemed to want to impress him, which also makes him seem like probably the coolest guy in that band.
Yeah, I read a thing that was like that he likes that the like the Rolling Stones was kind of like his day gig when he really maybe would have preferred to be playing like jazz or something different, you know?
Absolutely. And there were all these stories that came out about how he, you know, he had his signature Vic Firth sticks, but that he donated all the profits from that so that, you know, jazz drummers that he really admired, you know, could live out their later days in comfort, and just like all sorts of wonderful little quiet bits of charity to the jazz musicians that he really respected.
Yeah, that's so cool. I noticed that like sometimes when I'm listening to Rolling Stone songs that I haven't like listened to in a while, in the way that, like, when you sing along to songs, sometimes you're singing along to the lyrics, but, like, if you really love a song, then sometimes you're singing along to the guitar solo or you're, like, singing along to the drums. And, like, I find that a lot of times when I think I'm singing along to the drums, I'm, like, adding accents and stuff that aren't actually there. Like, it just makes me think of, like, how he really was able to do so much with so little. And there really is a lot of restraint. And, like, the drums are so exciting. And in my mind, I don't know if I'm articulating it well, but in my mind, it's always, like, I think he's doing more than he actually is, you know. And then you listen to it and it really is just like it's like tight and sparse and just like it's economical, right? It's like only what the song needs to just be fucking fantastic. And yeah, I don't know, this is sad, right? Because also there's not really another band from this era that was like still together and all alive and touring, right? Or is there anyone big that I'm not thinking of?
No, I mean Mick, Keith, and Charlie are the original Rolling Stones are Mick, Keith, Charlie, Brian Jones, who's dead, and Bill Wyman, who retired in 89. So more or less, the Rolling Stones are essentially the original Rolling Stones. But now it's kind of like the Who, you know, Roger Daltrey and Roger Daltrey and how's his name? Pete Townsend. He might have a different view of the Nirvana cover. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards are now like kind of the only two remaining guys. So it's not quite the same band anymore, you know, which is sad.
I want to add on a little bit to what Hallie was saying, which is that, you know, the Rolling Stones were a band I didn't appreciate for a long time, I think, because I wasn't impressed by the songs. And I think there's something in there about how the secret to that band was in the groove. There was a lot of ghost groove going on there. And that was, you know, for all the attention that gets paid to Mick and Keith, that the thing that was actually most exciting and interesting and unique about that band is in the rhythm section. And that sort of that pocket between the rhythm guitar and the drum parts.
Yeah.
And more. you get the final word on Charlie Watts, one of the most important drummers of all time in rock music. What do you got to say?
I was surprised to, like, you know he's old, and you know he just just had surgery and is recovering and stuff, but it was still like a surprise to see it and read it. And you know, he seemed like a really good guy, and he was in the band for so long and contributed to so much and inspired so many people, and you know, the music he made will live on through the generations for eternity.
And well said, and more. Who could say something better about the legacy of Charlie Watts? And here's something else that will live on through the generations. The new book by Franz Nicolai, Someone Should Pay for Your Pain, out now via Gibson House. And you can get it at your favorite bookstore. Franz, any last thing you want the listeners to know about? And also, thanks for being on the show. I appreciate you coming by. And thanks for being a good sport. I opened up with that ICP, little pop, you know, to fill out Franz, to see which Franz we're getting today. And listen, people, Franz came through in spades and schooled me with his academic approach to things. And I will say, made me look quite the fool yet again. So, Franz, thanks for coming on. Anything you want to say, anything you want the listeners to know about?
I mean, I'm here promoting the book, and I think they know about it. So I think job done.
Well, there you have it, people.
I'm excited for the book, honestly, Franz, yes. Because I just feel like it's going to sound stupid, but like, I love to read. I mean, I really love books. I do. I really love books. I love reading. But like, there's not a lot. Obviously, what we love about cinema and books is that we get to see life through someone else's eyes, or we get to check out a different scene than we're in, or we get to experience something so different from how we experience things. But like, I have a special connection to books that are rooted in people like me or my scene. And there's just not that many, unless I'm just not seeking them out. I just don't feel like I read a lot of fiction. It's like part of why I liked High Fidelity so much. It's like, oh wow, like these are like music people, and like I don't feel like I read a lot of fiction like that. So I don't know. I'm like very excited for this.
Yeah, that makes me think I actually do have something more to say about that, which is that, you know, there are a lot of music novels and there are a lot of rock novels, but they have a tendency to cluster around the same kind of rock that they write about. I think because, you know, a lot of writers are huge music fans and they really want to write about music, but they don't have a lot of personal experience as musicians. And so they tend to write about a sort of fantasized idea of that tends to gravitate towards like a very 60s or 70s idea of what a rock star is and what that kind of life is. And, you know, the music world has many mansions and there's a lot of different kinds of scenes to be writing novels about. And, you know, Nels Inc has one called Doxology that music scene is like the 90s Hoboken indie rock scene, which is great because nobody had written that novel before. And you know, in terms of the world that I think all of us on this podcast have spent a lot of time in, you know, there's some, you know, Aaron Cometbus has a couple works of fiction. There's Chris Terry who writes for Chris L. Terry, he likes to go by, who writes for Razor Cake, has a great novel called Black Card, which is about being mixed race in the Richmond punk scene in the aughts. And this one, you know, I can't offhand think of any others. And I hope if you have a listener who can correct me, I'm always looking for more. So I guess that's my contribution is the novel of that world.
Yeah.
Well, take a look. It's in a book. It's the new book by Franz Nicolai. Someone Should Pay for Your Pain. And we will see you next week.